This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I'm going to play you a recording of a speech by Robert Haworth, November 3, 2011, at the annual conference of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas, USA, in Washington, D.C. The recording is by Carl Etnier from Equal Time Radio, WDEV-FM, Waterbury, Vermont. Following this powerful speech, I will do a follow-up interview with Robert Haworth. Here is Cornell scientist and professor of ecology and biology, Robert Haworth, at the Washington ASPO USA conference.
I also have about 20 minutes, and I want to spend it going to more detail on this question of the greenhouse gas emissions. Let me jump right into the story. I want to put it in the context of climate change and how to think about climate change, and I want to emphasize a few times through the talk that I and many other Earth system scientists are very concerned about the fairly near-term consequences of global warming, what might happen over the next 20, 30, 50 years sort of time periods. The reason for that is in part the nature of the climate change system, and this is a cool little figure that came out earlier this year, sort of a survey of how Americans think about it. A lot of Americans think that the climate change is very stable, that lower left-hand corner there, things just roll along. Some people think that the climate is very unstable, always ready to just fall apart. The reality, of course, is what 34%, surprisingly large percentage of adult Americans believe, that the climate change is in a relatively stable hole. It takes some effort to disturb it and move it out of that hole, but we can. And the point is that the potential to move it into an alternate behavioral system is real. It's happened multiple times in the history of the Earth before. And there are a variety of tipping points which could happen, and there's reasons to think that many of those we could approach over the next century. Some of them we might approach over the next few decades. So clearly we don't want to move the climate change into a radically different environment. Slow warming is bad enough, but moving into a radically different climate system would be a much, much scarier possibility. Just want to hit on an example or two of the sort of tipping points which might happen. One of these we're starting to see already. The incidence of fires in tundra systems has gone up remarkably over the last decade, and that's because these systems, which did not have lightning storms for most of the past millennia, are getting a huge increase in lightning strikes because they're getting more cumulative weather in the Arctic, and that sets off fires, things burn, and you get some positive feedbacks from carbon dioxide release and change in albedo, et cetera. Another one that's quite scary is the possibility of melting permafrost and freeing up methane clathrates and methane hydrates, and thereby putting natural sources of methane very rapidly into the atmosphere at unprecedented rates. That's a very scary possibility, and I want to come back to that a little bit later on in my talk. Because of this concern, this umbrella group, the Council of Scientific Society Presidents, it's a group that represents collectively about 1.5 million U.S. scientists in 150 different disciplines. And the group, a year and a half ago, wrote a letter to Obama saying, you know, climate change is real. Your administration has to take it much more seriously. Secretary Chu had said that society needs to treat this as an emergency and put all of our resources behind it. He said that. We bought into that and told the president he should support Chu and move it forward. That quote at the bottom there, the necessary transition will require nothing short of a new industrial revolution. That's Secretary Chu's statement. I agree with that. The Council of Scientific Society of Presidents agreed to that. We urged the president to do that. And in this letter, we also pointed out that some solutions, in quotes, for global warming might not be solutions. We used two examples. One was corn ethanol. Might not be such a good idea for climate warming. Good politics, but not good for climate warming. And we also said shale gas might not be the panacea that people perceive. At the time we wrote this, there wasn't a huge amount of science behind that, but that was part of the point. We pointed out that the government was moving ahead on a policy based on precious little science. So what is the science? What is the role of shale gas in the context of global warming? And shale gas, as I'm sure you know, is widely promoted as this bridge fuel that allows society to replace oil, replace coal, continue to have a fossil fuel existence, and yet put out fewer greenhouse gas emissions than these other fossil fuels, so move us towards a climate future that might make sense. The question is that true? And that's what I'll spend my next 16 minutes on. Tony Ingraffia and Rene Santoro and I put out a paper on this subject in Climatic Change Letters, peer-reviewed paper, last April. This is the very first comprehensive study on this topic, whether in the peer-reviewed literature or not. So when you've heard before that, yeah, this is a great fuel, its greenhouse gas emissions are low. That's not based on anything out there in the literature to speak of. I'm going to run quickly through some of our work, and then I'm going to tell you what's been happening since our paper came out. It's only 6 months ago, but a lot's been happening. And this leads into the way I want you to think about it. This leads into the figure which Tony already showed you, sort of a summary figure we reprinted in Nature 7 weeks ago. So on the left there, the blue bars here are the direct emissions of carbon dioxide per energy produced, grams carbon as carbon dioxide per megajoule of energy released as heat energy when a fuel is burnt. And with the first two bars on the left are shale gas. I'll come back to why we have two in a minute. Next two are conventional natural gas. Then we have two bars for coal, one for surface mine coal and one for deep coal and one for diesel oil. And yes, indeed, the amount of carbon dioxide that's released to get a unit of energy from natural gas, whether shale gas or conventional gas, is far lower than that of coal or diesel. So in that sense, it's true. It's a clean fuel. The red bars there are the indirect emissions of carbon dioxide. We did a tedious little accounting exercise looking at the trucking of the water, the drilling of the pumps, the running of compressors, you name it. And those are our estimates of how much carbon dioxide is released in that. It's not trivial, but nor is it particularly exciting to look at. Renee Santoro, who's our co-author and worked on this, if I asked her to do something like this again, she'd probably quit in a minute. But anyway, very tedious. Methane is the story. And methane is what I want to concentrate on. Of course, natural gas is mostly methane, more than 90%. Methane is the second most important greenhouse gas in global warming, and exactly how much important it is compared to carbon dioxide is a function of your time scale of interest. I'll come back and say a little bit more about that. But Jim Hansen, whom I respect highly, has said that methane is responsible for 50% as much global warming as carbon dioxide at the moment. Okay, Tony showed you a video behind this. What I'm going to show you here is a built-up table. We're going to compare methane leakage from conventional gas and from shale gas at a series of steps. It's basically a life cycle analysis from the wellhead all the way through delivery of natural gas to final consumer. I'm going to go through this in a series of steps and add it in. So the first thing here is the initial completion. Right after we put that hydraulic fluids into the ground and do the fracturing, there's a flowback period, Tony said this, usually lasts about 2 weeks, give or take a few days, before the well is brought online and connected to a pipeline. There's no equivalent to that for conventional gas and not much methane leakage in this 2 week period, is what we're talking about. But we estimate that about 1.9% of the lifetime production of a shale gas well flows to the atmosphere in that sort of venting that Tony demonstrated at this point. Now, this is based on 5 studies, all unpublished, all industry sources. Most of them are from EPA PowerPoint presentations. Some are from other unpublished reports. Quality data is not good, but I'll come back with why I think it's believable in a minute. It's the best data that are out there as well. The rest of the comparisons I'm going to give you here, the other sources of methane, are the same for conventional gas and for shale gas, so keep that in mind. The next two here are after the well is finished and goes online over the lifetime of the well, about 7 years, we think, in the case of a shale gas well, longer for a conventional gas well, there is routine leaking and emissions at the well site. We used a study from the General Accountability Office that came out 16 months ago for that. Those are the numbers there. There's also this thing called liquid unloading. A fluid builds up in a well. The industry has to get the fluid out of there to increase the productivity of the well, and they vent methane when they do that. That number also is from the General Accountability Office. So you sum those up, and you have a comparison of sort of the wellhead processes for leakage from conventional gas versus shale gas. There's more from shale gas because of this initial venting. We've gotten a huge amount of feedback, both positive and negative, on the paper since it came out 6 months ago. Huge amount of stuff in the blogosphere and some stuff in the peer-reviewed literature I'll get to in a minute. But one of the criticisms is that we just can't be right on the initial shale gas number. It doesn't agree at all with what the Environmental Protection Agency says. So I want to point out here that actually our number is dead on with what the Environmental Protection Agency says. Their latest greenhouse gas inventories, which was done after our paper and partially in response to our paper, says that up to this stage, 3.4% of the lifetime production of a gas well comes out as methane, right in our mid-range. Gas sometimes has to be processed to get rid of sulfides or some other hydrocarbons. We used information from the American Petroleum Institute for that. And as I say here, this gets you up to sort of to storage and long-range transmission distribution storage part of gas. So this is only part of the comparison of the total emissions to the atmosphere associated with gas use. And the rest would be storage and transmission and distribution. And I want to admit right up front that there are not really good data on what the emissions are here. But there's a lot of purposeful venting that's associated with storage as well in order to keep pressures under control. And there are leaks from pipelines. The average long-distance transmission pipeline in the United States is more than 50 years old. They leak. We get big accidents. Rob and I were part of a workshop in Boston a few weeks ago where there are all sorts of industry experts talking about this, and there are huge numbers of routine leaks, which industry just doesn't find it cost-effective to capture. This isn't the high-pressure transmission lines. Local distribution systems within cities are probably worse. I'll take the city of Philadelphia for an example. The system was laid down 85 years ago. For the most part, it's cast iron pipes that are not welded together. They're stuck end-to-end. They had a sealant in them, which probably disappeared back in the 1920s or 1930s. They have not been repaired. And the city, by looking at what they put into the system versus what comes out, estimate that they lose about 3% of what they put in just within their city system. So leaky systems. So we came up with an estimate of 1.4 to 3.6% loss during that part of the process, and I really don't want to spend much time defending that at the moment. I'm happy to later. It's not a very good number. The data behind it aren't very good, but I actually think it's conservative, which gives us those sort of ranges for the total loss from shale gas and conventional gas wellhead to consumer. Now, how do we put that in context with carbon dioxide in terms to get to the overall greenhouse gas footprint of the technology? And the way we do that is by what's called a global warming potential. It's how much more effective methane is as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And it is a function of the time of interest of study. So in this figure, which Tony's already showed, this is from Nature. They glossed it up over what we published originally, but it's from our April paper. This is the 20-year integrated analysis of how methane looks. So the upper bars there are the methane. The one on the left, the first two, are the low estimate and high estimate for shale gas methane, then the same for conventional gas, then surface and deep mine coal, and for diesel. So there's methane loss from all of those, but it's much larger in the natural gas industry. And at this time scale, using the global warming potential we did, and I'll come back to that in a second, this fuel actually has a greenhouse gas footprint that is far worse than the other fossil fuels I'm showing you there. Top figure here is the same as that of our real paper, not glossed up by Nature. So again, at this 20-year integrated time frame, the greenhouse gas footprint is quite large for methane. Methane has a residence time in the atmosphere of about a decade compared to about a century for carbon dioxide. So as you look into longer time frames, the influence of methane is diminished, and that's shown in the lower figure, 100-year integrated time frame after emission. And here the shale gas is, depending on whether you want to look at our low or high estimate, it roughly is in the range of what fuels like coal are. It's not particularly better, not particularly worse. Now again, I want to emphasize, we showed both the short and long time frame in our paper because both are important. They're important for different reasons, but I'm particularly concerned about the short time frame, and I want to explain to you why. When we sent our paper out for review, they suggested that we leave out the 100-year time frame, we concentrate on the short, because all climate change scientists know we need to concentrate in that short time frame. We didn't. We included both, and we've been blasted in the blogosphere for even thinking of including the short time frame. You should only include the long time frame. I'm concerned about the short time frame. Why? This figure, how many of you have seen this figure? It's from a new report. UNEP and World Meteorological Organization put out just this past summer. And what it shows is the Earth's average temperature there up until 2009. That's the squiggly line. And then some projections of where we might go into the future. And what's called the reference line there is the IPCC sort of status quo scenario of what will happen if society continues to plug away more or less as we are. And you'll see we get into that yellow, which is a worrisome area of global warming, where UNEP and World Meteorological Organization think we may well start to encounter some tipping points. We get there pretty soon, and then we get up into that orange pretty soon, not that many years out. The other figures on there are what we might do about it. The first line down is CO2 measures. That's as if we were to, as a world, take on aggressive carbon dioxide controls now, immediately. There'd be a delay in seeing an influence on temperature, but over the next several years, say by 2040, we'd start to see some influence of that and some curving off, but we'd still be seeing dangerous tipping points. The lowest line down there, which says CO2 and methane and BC, that stands for black carbon measurements. That is if we took aggressive efforts to control CO2, methane, and black carbon now. And that gives us some hope of keeping the climate where we might want it to be. The one just above that, the blue line, which looks about the same for until 2040 and then starts to go up, that's as if we controlled methane and black carbon alone and not CO2.
This is Radio EcoShock. You are listening to Cornell University Professor Robert Howarth on shale gas fracking and climate change. This speech was November 3rd at the ASPO USA Peak Oil and Gas Conference in Washington, D.C. Here again is Robert Howarth.
The point is that we're better off, if we're worried about short-term climate, to control methane than anything else. And we need to control methane, and we need to do so in that time frame if we want to avoid these tipping points. And if you have any doubt about that, I'd commend this paper to you by Hansen et al. It came out 4 years ago, Climate Change and Trace Gases. It highlights the need to control methane. And he says strongly that we need to control methane as well as carbon dioxide, and we need to be doing so from now if we want to avoid dangerous tipping points. And he particularly leads out the 1.8 degrees from the background temperature change as a tipping point where he believes we might run into melting of permafrost, methane clathrates, methane hydrates, and get into a runaway positive feedback of methane from natural sources. Where does that put on here? The red line is that 1.8 degrees. Status quo will get there in about 2030, 20 years from now. And the only way, according to this UNEP WMO assessment, that we're going to avoid that is to put on aggressive controls for methane and black carbon now. Okay, our paper came out in April. It was really the first study that looked comprehensively at this, certainly the first one to include methane at all. Since then, there's been a host of papers. I'm going to run through them here. There's one more. If you really follow us closely, you might ask me later. It's a paper by Hultman and all that came out last week that I haven't had time to put on here, but it basically tracks the Scone paper there. You can keep it in mind. Scone is a surrogate for Hultman if you want to think about it. I want to tell you what these papers say. Some of them basically say we're right. Some of them say we're wrong. More of these say we're wrong than right. I want to show you what's driving that conclusion. So here I'm comparing some of the major assumptions behind our study and behind the other studies, which, again, have all come out since April. And I'll go through this. It says draft. Please do not quote, because we're hoping to get a paper out on this, which we'll be submitting in about 2 to 3 weeks. And there's a pretty good chance some of these numbers will change by 4 or 5%, and I'd rather not be nitpicked on that sort of small change. But the picture is pretty robust, and these will be ready to be quoted within the month if people are interested. So first, the time scale. Again, we looked at the 20 and 100-year studies. So did David Hughes in a study that came out shortly after ours. The next three papers down only looked at the 100 years. They said there's no value to looking at the short time frame. The paper at the bottom is one by Tom Wigley, and he looked at it continuously. He didn't use this global warming potential idea because he thinks it's too simplistic. He used a more sophisticated atmospheric chemistry model. He looked continuously over a 200-year time frame, but it certainly includes a shorter time frame. The next factor over there is the global warming potential. We used 105 for the 20-year time period and 33 for the 20-year time period, as did Hughes. Again, Wigley didn't use this because he didn't use that approach, but the other three studies here all used 25. Now, why did we use a higher number than they used? Because there's a paper that came out by Drew Schindel in 2009 in Science explaining that methane has a higher global warming potential than the IPCC had previously believed. And for context, Drew Schindel is now the lead author on the next IPCC assessment on this. So the next IPCC assessment is very likely to say that. But the other papers said, no, we shouldn't have done that. We should have used the old IPCC assessment that predates the newer science. The next here is the methane leakage. It's the grams methane as carbon per megajoule of energy released in heat energy. Our numbers work out to a range of 0.56 to 1.3. David Hughes used our numbers from the analysis. The next three studies all end up around 0.34 or so. Wigley didn't make an assumption. He tested a range of assumptions. And I want to point out that the EPA new official numbers, which have come out since our paper was done, are slightly lower than ours. They're between 0.49 to 0.78, but they overlap and they're in the range of ours, and they're well above the other papers which have come out in between. And, of course, if you want to compare with coal, you need to look at the methane leakage from coal. Those are our numbers. They're right on with the EPA. We actually go much higher on the surface, on the deep mine coal, but we're right on with the EPA for surface coal. And the other studies, particularly Scone and this Liedes-Hutland paper, have methane from coal that are based on 35-year-old literature and are patently wrong. So where does that leave you? The red papers here are the ones that said we're wrong. No, shale gas footprint isn't as bad as coal. And that's true if you take the 100-year time frame, low estimates of methane from shale gas, high from coal, and the low global warming potential. The major driver on this, quite frankly, is the time frame, not the assumptions about the methane leakage. The other studies all say, no, shale gas is worse than coal on time frames of at least up to 50 years. And again, that is a very robust conclusion. You'd also get the same conclusion from the other studies there if you looked at the less than 50-year time period. So I think we have a pretty robust result. I do want to say, though, that the major projection is that shale gas, if it's developed the way that energy industry and government believe, is not likely to be a huge increase in the amount of natural gas in the country, and it's thought to largely replace conventional gas and the conventional uses of conventional gas. And that means that the greenhouse gas footprint will go up because you're taking conventional gas, which has lower methane emissions, and substituting in shale gas. And the shale gas emissions are 50 to 60% higher, according to either us or the EPA, and therefore the greenhouse gas emissions will go up. Now, can emissions be reduced? There's a lot of interest in that, and I'd be really happy to take questions and talk about later. Let me just very quickly say yes. Clearly, the sort of emissions we talked about can be reduced. But it's not all accidental leakage. A lot of this is purposeful venting. It's part of the design plan of how the industry operates, and that's based on their current sense of economics. So going to my third point down there, economics alone is not likely to drive a reduction in that. It would require very strong regulation if we're going to do it. Certainly a lot could be done at wellhead to reduce leakages. A lot of technology exists. We're left with the problem of leakages in storage systems and in pipelines. And again, these are old systems. It would be extremely expensive to replace the pipeline infrastructure of the United States. And it might make sense if we're looking at natural gas as a long-term solution, but if we're viewing it as a bridge fuel over several decades, it may not make economic sense. Just to put the economics in context, to give you some sense of what industry may or may not be willing to do in terms of reducing these emissions, this shows the price of natural gas from 1975 up until a few months ago, and it peaked a few years ago, which is when industry got really excited about shale gas. It's gone back down. I've got two lines on there. One is what the International Energy Administration announced last week in Paris is the break-even point for the U.S. industry. It's about $6.17 per 1,000 cubic feet. If the price of gas is less than that, they say industry's losing money. And the other is some estimates from Art Berman, who puts it higher. Either way, you can see that industry's not making a lot of money at the moment, and that, of course, is going to make them resistant to putting in environmental control generally, or methane controls in particular. I mentioned that our numbers compare pretty favorably with the new EPA numbers for emission estimates, and I've said that several times. So I want to give you a little bit of context with that and then move you towards what that looks for the United States as a whole. Back in 1996, the EPA, working with industry, came up with a series of emission factors for methane from the natural gas and oil industries. And up until this past year, that is what the EPA has used and what the IPCC has used globally for estimating what the role of the natural gas industry is in methane emissions. EPA completely redid their analysis and released some preliminary stuff on that 11 months ago, and they've since then put out three or four reports, and they're continuing to update it. They've increased the emission factors in many parts of the oil and gas industry substantially in terms of methane leakage. So what does that mean? I just want to show you, this is what the total U.S. greenhouse gas inventory looks like for the base year of 2008, and I'm picking that just because it's the last year where I can compare old and new EPA numbers. On the left is what the EPA would have been saying a year ago were the emissions for 2008, and the numbers on the right are what they say for the same base year they now are with the new emission number. So the total greenhouse gas emissions of the United States have gone up. That's because of a change in the methane numbers. The methane emissions have gone up, and the methane from natural gas has gone up. So you can see here that we would now say 3.5% of the total greenhouse gas footprint in the United States comes from methane leakage from the natural gas industry. That doesn't sound like a huge amount, but they're using a global warming potential of 21, based on what the IPCC said back in 1996. That's a 100-year time frame and a really old number. I asked them why they did that, and they said, for political reasons, we were told to use that number. That's what Kyoto Protocol said, we're going to use it. Okay, the new number, if you want to use a shorter time frame, would be 105 instead of 21. So let me just show you what that does. On the left axis is the greenhouse gas emissions. Total emissions is the top line. The second one is the methane emissions, and they run parallel. And on the bottom is what we assume for the global warming potential for methane, starting on the left with a factor of 21, which is what the EPA is using, and going way over to 105, which is the most recent and best number for the shorter time frame of 20 years. The point is that if you take the 100-year time frame and use an old analysis, methane is not that big of a story. But if you take the short time frame, which I think you have to if you're serious about this tipping point, and we use the most recent science, then methane is making up 44% of the entire greenhouse gas footprint in the United States, and the single largest source of that is the natural gas industry. So I think we need to pay attention to that. Thank you very much, and again, I'm really pleased to be part of this today.
That was Dr. Robert Haworth of Cornell, co-author of the peer-reviewed paper, Methane and the Greenhouse Gas Footprint of Natural Gas from Shale Formations. My thanks to the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas, USA, for this presentation, and to Carl Etnier from Equal Time Radio on WDEV Waterbury, Vermont, for the recording. And thank you to Radio EcoShock DC correspondent Jerry Williams.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.